Yes. Oh, okay. Well, I wasn't planning on really showing materials. I think I've inundated the commissioners regarding documentation, though. Oh, okay. 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 I see. I mean, yeah, a little bit. Yep, you get most of it, I guess, up to this point, but yeah. No, that's okay. And as a matter of fact, I have a national radio show, right? And I broadcast at 3 o'clock our time. So I'll probably need to cut about 10 minutes before. Yeah, okay. All right. Right, and so one of the big questions you guys are going to get is, well, what's the authenticity? I mean, is this a legitimate thing? And so I wanted to kind of cover that. But, okay, so, yeah, sure, no problem. I'll bet. Yeah, it's about 80 here. Yeah, it is. Enjoy it. Matter of fact, it wasn't too long ago. We actually had snow at the end of September, so just a few years. I mean, I think, yeah, my mom was still alive, and she died in 2019, so I'm going to say it was probably 2018. So, anyway. Really? And what year was that? 2008, 2009? Oh, okay. I know there was a banner year of snow in 08, 09, I think. That's when I wasn't here, but I think the area received like 182 inches of snow. Wow. Well, it's not just deep, but compacted deep, right? Yeah. Yeah. Ah. Okay, so one of the things that I think is going to be important to understand is the veracity or the legitimacy of using committees. Now, I could go through the Magna Carta and the right of petition and the concept of assembling, because that's when that was the real birth of individual liberty, individual sovereignty in modern day history. And so as we kind of migrated from actually England migrated from a theocracy under the Roman Catholic Empire into their own theocracy and monarchy, as we were being founded as colonies and so forth, and they had the glorious revolution in the mid-1600s or late 1600s, that's when they created the Glorious Bill of Rights. And so some of those documents I sent to you, and I kind of highlighted petitioning, assembly, and this concept of, you know, people getting engaged. And one of the things that is really worth pointing out historically in American colony state history or the Union history is when England started oppressing the colonies, what they started doing was putting stamp taxes, those types of things that led up to the Revolutionary War. And when that started happening, the Englishmen, or I should say the colonists, started organizing themselves, and they formally organized themselves when the king, when the tyranny got so heavy that the king dismissed the state governments and started instituting his own governments. When that happened, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back, and the people started forming under the rights of assemblies these republican forms of government where they could organize and petition the king, again going back to the right of petitioning and organizing to do so. And another part of this in the monarchical history is the concept of common law grand juries, the citizen grand juries. Under the rights of the citizens, they had mechanisms of opposing tyranny. And so getting organized was essential. So that's why I sent you the Tory Acts, and I referenced the different names that this different colonies or states actually referred to. Some of them were committees, some of them were councils, some of them were assemblies and conventions. And so each of the states had their own name for it, but they were basically in acting upon their fundamental rights under the fact that they were Englishmen, that the Bill of Rights and common law and English law allowed this to for them to organize in standing up against oppression. So they created these committees. They created these committees at the state level, created the committees of correspondence, which basically moved us into the Declaration of Independence, which then we evolved into this Constitution. All of these things were maintained, but some things were expanded upon. We no longer had a magistrate government. We actually have now a three branches of government. They took the magistrate and divided it into legislative and then executive and judiciary. The most powerful, and the framers in ratifying or in the ratification base as well as the Constitutional Convention, they were talking about this, the sovereignty being rested with our republican form of government, our representatives. And technically, in a republican form of government, That means that when we have problems or issues, most all problems and issues can and should be resolved by representation, not by the courts. As a matter of fact, the framers never dreamed of having such an elaborate court system. And when they created the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, they actually created and sanctified this thing called a trial by jury. Because the trial by jury in the Seventh Amendment, let me kind of turn to that real quick. The Seventh Amendment, and this is what it says, in suits at common law, and let me give you an example. Divorce is a suit in common law. And so in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, and I don't know any divorce that does not exceed $20. In suits of common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by jury shall otherwise be re-examined by the court. So in other words, we're supposed to have trials by jury when we look at common law. But a lot of things happened, and getting into the history of all of that will become a part of this discovery that this committee will actually provide. But in essence, this committee... when we look at how the committees created the state, this shadow government for the state, and then they created the Continental Congress, and then they ended up creating the Articles of Confederation, and then another committee was formed to create the Constitution. These are representatives of the people. So when the Constitutional Convention was created, or I should say when they executed that, each state sent delegates. The only state that didn't was, or actually they showed up and they went back, was Rhode Island. They didn't participate. So all states were basically at the altar when they were creating this government for the federal government. And in so doing, they basically, instead of sending it back to the state legislatures and keeping this concept of the power of the people, actually having the decisions and the power, the concept of jury nullification, that is a common law concept. And we kind of see that today. And sometimes it's acceptable in our current court system, and sometimes it's not, because we see sometimes courts actually, or judges, will step in when it's a jury trial, not a trial by jury, but a jury trial. A judge will step in and basically set aside the jury, verdict and actually impose his own. And I could give you cases of that, but nevertheless, the point is that when the Constitution went out for ratification, instead of it going straight to the legislature, they basically said, we're going to send this to the people. The people are going to create a convention, they're going to send their delegates, and they're going to debate the Constitution and ratify it. Instead of just allowing the state legislature to vote up and down, or debate a little bit and vote up or down, because they knew during the Constitutional Convention that the states were not going to be willing to give up this power. Because every state that was in that room of the convention, they all basically started admitting how their state was guilty of inflating their currency. They were guilty of all sorts of problems. And so they said, we've got to bypass them and put this in the power of the people, which is what they did. And because... that was a record. We don't recognize these things anymore because we actually have all these different forms of government. But under the Constitution, we're guaranteed a Republican form of government. And so we have to restore that. And in essence, that's what this Republican form of committee will do, because as representatives, as you representatives of the people of Stevens County, have the power to create a committee. This committee can actually function as... you've heard of grand juries. I actually look at this because of the size of this and because of the body of what it can do. It could actually function as a super jury. Now, grand juries sometimes are used for criminal indictment, but they're also used, or these large juries are used, for establishing axioms. In other words, when you look at this grand jury that they called Continental Congress, at that point in time, they had the power, and they created an axiom called the Declaration of Independence. And so under that Declaration of Independence, it became a founding plank of how we were to institute government. And so all government, based on this tenet within the Declaration, all governments are instituted by we the people. And therefore, we the people, we have to start looking at our government. Is that what we instituted, and is that what we did? And that's what this committee will do. So if you had a chance to look at the the flow chart. It's big, it's busy, and I'll let you digest it, because I lay out the flow of why you initiate this committee, and bottom line, there's one or two ways you can initiate a committee. One, you can acknowledge and recognize that we're living under so much federal tyranny, we're in a constitutional crisis. And I actually have an email that I sent to the state legislatures a couple of years ago that basically made that declaration, that how can you not call this a constitutional crisis when the federal government is exercising powers they don't possess, and they're actually exercising powers that the way they're exercising them, they're causing economic, the same thing as economic warfare. They're instituting economic warfare, they're instituting chemical warfare, they're psyops, the fact that they've instituted systems such as our current election system. As we go ahead, you got a question? Okay, so fine. So when we look at the current election system, the federal government designed it. They have no authority to be involved in designing and implementing. That is actually, the states have that overarching umbrella, but when you read the state constitutions, do the states actually have the authority to execute all of the elections? In other words, do they have the ability to control them to that degree? I will tell you that when you look at Washington State Constitution and elections in the Constitution, it doesn't say the counties can't run their own. And as a matter of fact, counties can have and run their own. As long as, you know, they want, technically, if the state is funding it, you can pull the funds back and say, we want to run our own elections. But the point is there's two mechanisms. There's the mechanism of acknowledging that we have a constitutional crisis, and that as the committee, you need to get down to some brass tacks and understand, is this stuff constitutional? In other words, you may not have the know-how. And actually, one of the things I sent you was the debates of the Bill of Rights in Congress, and this concept of petitioning and instructing. Believe it or not, the reason they didn't include instruction in the Bill of Rights, and the First Amendment right of petitioning, they didn't include instruction, was because many of the representatives in Congress, in the legislature in Congress, they basically said, you know, I don't like the idea of my constituents coming and lecturing me on government, because most of them were pretty stupid. But it became kind of an integrated part, because technically when you look at a petition does provide instruction. And so we have a lot of petitions that we provide, and so we can use a petition to actually help the county establish, because in all of our petitions we call upon the counties to establish this committee to actually come to a clear knowledge, because as a Republican form of government, you guys have to make this decision. The way we've been functioning since the 1830s or so, or actually even before that, they started shifting our form of government to a judiciary form of government, where the judiciary started assuming all of these powers. So one of the things that this committee will do is I'm actually going to expose to the committee, and everybody will actually see for themselves how the judiciary was able to assume these powers outside of the Constitution. And when you see this, when you see how Hamilton basically stuck a bunch of things in the Federalist Papers well after the Constitution was ratified, it's almost like, you know, I've got the terms and conditions of the contract, you sign it, and then I go over here and amend it and add all these different paragraphs and say, well, that's a legitimate part of the contract. No, I'm sorry, it's not. And as a matter of fact, I prove, and I've proven this to the nation on my show, how Hamilton did all of this after the fact. And what he ended up doing was he used his friend, John Marshall, to basically set aside the ratification debates, because I've already told you about how important they are, and to use the Federalist Papers, because they knew in the back of the Federalist Papers what Hamilton put in, it would give them the power to interpret, create implications of law, and so forth, so that they actually could start molding, changing, and inflicting law upon us where they actually have no legislative authority. Everybody scratches their head. The Constitution doesn't say that, but how is this an acknowledged thing? Oh, well, you'll get that out of the Federalist Papers. You don't get that out of the ratification debates. And as a matter of fact, Hamilton made no comment regarding implied powers or interpretation. None of those things were mentioned by Hamilton in the New York ratification debates while he was writing these Federalist Papers and publishing them. Because New York ratified well after the Constitution was ratified. New Hampshire was the first state to ratify, and that happened June 21st. But anyway, long story short, this is more than just baked in. This is a fundamental, I'll just say, sacred part of our government. This trial by jury are allowing the people, giving the people the power to actually look at the facts and make a determination and empower their representatives to say, this is what we need to do. So when you look at this flow chart, you'll actually see how, you know, I provide you with, you know, how do you initiate this either by using a petition, because I've got petitions, or you can just acknowledge. You can look at the state of things today and go, they're using environmental regulations to basically conduct warfare against us. The state of Washington has nothing within its state regarding the environment. And they're basically making edicts that we have to get rid of combustion engines. Right? And that was a part of the energy policy as well as the federal energy policy as well as the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. And so how is it that they're able to do these things when they're not enumerated? So we actually have a whole bunch of petitions. I've got 20 right now. The 20th petition is challenging, actually pointing out that the federal government has no ability to allow a foreign entity to own any state or to sell, that the states can sell any part of their state or any resource to a foreign entity. In other words, when you look at this concept of, you know, China buying up our farmland or anybody doing that from another nation or owning businesses or anything else, how did that happen? That was unconstitutional and it was not happening until after 9/11 with the Patriot Act. That's when they started opening that door of creating this symbiosis or supposedly a symbiotic relationship with foreign governments. And when we look at my second treaty points out how the federal government cannot make a treaty to adjoin the federal government and the states to another foreign polity. If it's not enumerated, if it's not within the enumerated powers, then they cannot use a treaty to presume those powers. In other words, and this was during the ratification debates, and all of these things will be provided to this committee, because the committee is going to need to have a library. And, oh, by the way, over the past year or so, the federal government has been scrubbing very important documentation so that it's not easily accessible, so that a researcher can't find anything. One of the things that I noticed that they scrubbed away was Tar Fox. Tar Fox was an operation that was conducted by NASA and the University of Washington in the 1990s, and this is where they went up into the air, the stratosphere and troposphere, and they started injecting these mists of metals and particulates into the air to watch for the prevailing winds, what we know as the beginning or the birth of chemtrails. Tar Fox was the initiation of all of that. And so that is, you used to be able to go to NASA and actually look at all these documents, and now they're gone. And as a matter of fact, when they sent out the notice to the state legislatures in 2023, Tar Fox was still out there. But all of a sudden, after that, since I went back to look and I go, wow, they've scrubbed that. I actually had to pull in our archive copies because it's getting harder and harder to find. And when people look at it, they go, huh, they don't really understand what Tar Fox was about, because now we don't understand how they got to a point of doing what they're doing, if this all makes sense. It's the same thing with, if you go to the Congressional Globe, that's where we used to be able to go and look at the debates during certain years. I think we could say probably 1819 to 1873, something like that, was the records or the storage of the congressional records of those debates and everything that was stated in both the House and the Senate. In other words, these were the records that the people could go and see what they said, what they passed, and what they did. Now you have to go to the Library of Congress, and good luck finding it, because getting those. So I actually sent you two links of what those documents look like. One link is the Bill of Rights, where you can actually go read what they said in the debates of the Bill of Rights in the very first session of Congress. The other link is the debates on the 14th Amendment. And when you look at these two documents that I have, you'll find that these things are a treasure trove of understanding what the Bill of Rights, why they did this, and why the petition and instruction of our public servants was the most heavily debated part of the Bill of Rights. Out of all of them, that was the one that was really contested amongst amongst the members of the House of Representatives. They did not like the idea of dumb constituents teaching them. But apparently, I think it's kind of the divine hand of providence, because back in those days, they may not have understood, but we've all gotten so illiterate that we all need instruction. We all need this kind of help. But back to the documents, we need to create this repository, and there's ways of doing this. And so I actually put it in the flow chart of where you can get some of the repositories of the ratification debates and these other essential documents that will lay out the facts. One of the things that also is important is is the layout of the petition, or I should say the layout of the committee and all of that. So I think all of that is in there, where you can kind of say, okay, how are we going to do this? It should be representative. In other words, if you just take a bunch of people from Suncrest to create this committee, then it would not be representative of the county. You need to make sure it's as representative as possible. And don't be, today with technology, it shouldn't be too hard to actually break this committee into three subcommittees, where you have District 1, District 2, and District 3. Because I'm going to presume that between the three districts, there's kind of an equality of population. Is that not correct? Okay. So if there's an equality of population, then if you break them into three districts, then each district could actually go through the work and basically come up to and have their own verdicts. And bottom line, what you would then do is, instead of going by popular vote of a democracy, having a large committee, you basically have, all you need are two districts to pass or ratify a decision, such as, well, the first decision, by the way, you'll have to decide, is which constitution is legitimate. So I know Wes probably knows this, but Greg and Mark, did you know that there's actually more than one constitution? Okay, so, no, U.S. Constitution, the federal constitution, there's currently two. Now, there have been other predecessors that the federal government created, or other efforts and people, what have you, but the current constitution that the federal government uses is called the Annotated Constitution. And I actually document this in Why Counties Matter Most. It's another article I could send to you. It's a good 70-page read. But inside this, I actually show how they take a definition in the Constitution and they tell you how they define it. And so they do not have the authority to do that. And as a matter of fact, the Constitution was all the definitions of what every line meant was already provided by the ratification debates. And so one of the things that we'll also do is you'll delineate what is the legitimate constitution. And, you know, not to be a spoiler here, but the reality is that the only legitimate constitution is the one that was actually ratified, the original text. And the definitions must be from the ratification debates. And I'll actually provide to you Madison's debates in Congress, so like the very early debate of the Assumption Act, the very first challenges of the Constitution, where Hamilton was really trying to imply powers. And Madison came in, and what he came in with were the ratification debates. He says, look, this is how the states understood this Constitution to mean. We cannot start applying new definitions. He lays this out. When you read this, you'll go, wow. The Federalist Papers or anything else cannot be used. The only thing we can use is how the ratification debates, or how the Federalists in the ratification debates stipulated what each line meant. In other words, Madison is pointing to fundamental contract law. I think I've used the analogy before that if I'm selling you, Greg, a car, I'm a car dealer, you're going to throw the cash down. You're walking out and paying for that, so you're no mortgage or no loan or anything else. And I say, you know what, Greg, as long as you own this car, you can bring it to this dealership, and we're going to wash and wax it once a week for you. And you go, you know what, you got a deal. I'm going to buy this car, and we sign the paperwork that you're going to go take and put the title in your name. You're going to insure it. You're taking full liability. And you walk out, you come back in the next week, and you say, I want my car wash and wax, with this big grin on your face, knowing, you know, what a savings that is. And I said, oh, shoot, we didn't put that in the contract. Fundamental contract law doesn't mean it has to be in writing. It just has to be agreed. And so anything that's stipulated in accepting a compact or a contract or a treaty, when it's stipulated, it becomes legally binding. And therefore, all you need, Greg, unfortunately, you have to drag me to court because I'm a scoundrel, but all you need is some witness, two people, or some form of evidence that I actually made that stipulation. And guess what? The court's hands are tied. The court will have to say, yes, he does deserve that, you know, car wash and wax, because it was stipulated, and here's the evidence of that. The ratification debates is the evidence of how they stipulated what that line really meant. And the beautiful thing, having read them several times and compared them, there is no disharmony. They are congruent. They are meshing. They may say the same thing in different ways, but they all basically support the same concept of what the necessary and proper clause meant. There are no general powers. When they look at what they call the general powers clause, they actually said that there are no general powers. And they explain why the general defense and welfare clause in the preamble of Article 1, Section 8 is just that, a preamble. It's just basically a declaratory statement of why these following powers are being granted. And so as they go through all of this, they really help stipulate, and Wes came up with a term, and I forgot what that term was, but where you actually, I'll call it canonizing the Constitution, because what we'll do, and this is, this formalizing the definitions of the Constitution, so for every clause of the Constitution, if it was articulated, stipulated, or what have you by Federalists in the ratification debates, you put a footnote. And then you build that footnote to include all of the ratification debates. So when somebody clicks on that footnote, they'll be able to go to that page and see all of the different ways it was defined to help clarify exactly what that means. And in so doing, it takes away a jurist's ability to insert their own definitions and interpretations. Does that make sense? And that actually, we're actually supporting the fundamentals of contract law. I mean, contract law has never really deviated since God started creating covenants. Because we all understand what a covenant is the same thing as a contract. It's just between you and a divine being. So anyway, so that's the first order of what this committee will do. And then, once this committee does this, then the next step is to start auditing the federal constitution. And I stipulate how to do that. And then the next thing is they need to also, after auditing the federal constitution, it'll be a breeze to audit the state constitution, because we already know that there are certain things that will be unconstitutional that the federal government has created and demanded of the state. And I'll give you a couple examples. Labor, Environmental Protection Agency, housing, and those types of standards, right? I mean, those are just a few. And so as we look at energy is another one. And so as we look at the federal constitution and go, how is it that we actually have offices and our government, the Washington state government has offices. We're taking tax dollars to support Washington government to interface with an unconstitutional agency of the federal government. So that's how we'll actually be able to start looking at the state constitution quickly and go, oh, well, this stuff's got to go. And so what ends up happening is you create these declarations that all these things are unconstitutional. In line with all of this, everything you do, and if you look at the flow chart, because there's a lot of data. If you actually look at it, I think it's probably 20 pages. Let me look at it real quick. As I look at the Visio diagram, I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4. It's 4 pages up and down and 3 pages wide, so it's a total of 12 pages. And so it's a large flow diagram or flow chart. But when you look at it, you'll actually start going through these audits and so forth. While you're doing this, every step of the way, you're communicating to every county in the state of Washington what you're doing. In other words, we've declared that we're currently in a constitutional crisis. We're creating a committee to do this, or we've endorsed, because I have all these petitions, we've endorsed this petition, and we're going to go down this path of using this committee, a constitutional compliance committee, to confirm what's constitutional, what isn't constitutional. And so that's why the initial canonizing and definitizing, determining what constitution is legitimate, is kind of critical to do all of that up front. But nevertheless, the point is that we start going down this path, and you're making these assertions, you're going to send it out, and what will end up happening is these other counties are basically going to come along and say ditto. And actually, most of the work that you do, the first committee that does this will basically do probably the bulk of the heavy lifting, because when other counties look at it, there may be some that will actually challenge it and go through and cross T's and dot I's, and they'll go, you know what, this is good, or they may actually find some things we missed. And that's good, because it's all about making things right and better and tighter. And so the whole point is by the time we get 2/3 of the counties in this state to have, you know, gone through and formed these committees, and you go through this process of the flow chart, we will then be at critical mass of basically calling for the state to convene a constitutional convention. You're actually calling all the counties of the state to convene a constitutional convention to literally take back the state constitution and actually readjust the powers that they should have. Because bottom line, the power is in the people, and one of the things that you'll also notice is that the people need to create county constitutions. That's one of the last things we do before we move towards a state constitution. But the whole point is, as you look at this whole flow chart and this whole process, all of these people that are going to be involved in this large committee, they're going to start understanding the ins and outs and the gazintas and gazautas of constitutions, why we have limited to defined constitutions, and why we have all of these checks and balances and these ancillary checks and so forth, so that by the time we move forward to actually provide a constitution, everybody's going to be very wary of providing any excessive power to any government. Does that make sense? No? Okay, all right. So the real point is that as every state was being formed, and as going back to this fundamental tenet of the Declaration of Independence, we look at how we the people are supposed to institute our government. One of the things we didn't do is we did not institute our county government. How was our county government created? Out of all of the 37 states that joined the Union after the original 13, the federal government did it for us, because they had this incentive to literally create states so that they could tax them. If the states meandered and took a long time, it would take a longer time for them to, you know, get into the Union, because you can't tax a territory based on the Constitution. You can only tax states, and the states, the taxation was done by apportionment by the people in the state. But getting more states, you know, added and more states in, because as you start looking at it, there was a lot of territory of the United States and a lot of people out in those territories and doing good things, and they had no mechanism of taxing them. And so this is how they started actually appointing and sending judges and just kind of kick-starting these territories and county governments. The people never took it upon themselves to actually establish and create a limited and defined county government. The key thing here is, when we really look at it, in those days, how much of government was involved in the people's lives back then? How much? Any guess? You're right. So they didn't provide health care. As a matter of fact, they didn't even provide roads. As a matter of fact, the way roads were done is, you know, the neighbors kind of got on their horse and went back and forth to their friends, and you probably would find trails of, and you, actually, if you were smart, you could figure out what people got along, because there'd be no trails between these homes and these other homes. And then, as everybody kind of meandered from their home into town, they would kind of start merging upon a main trail, and then that town may have a main trail out to another town. And so we created trails on our own. Down the road, it became incumbent on the expanse of productivity that the state created this, what we'll call the road system. So they started getting involved in creating roads because they, to help provide productivity for you, employment, and so forth, highways, waterways, and those types of things, help lend to productivity. The faster people can travel to work and get home, the more productive they are. You would think that it would be incumbent upon, I would say, our government to actually, you know, let us travel as fast as we possibly can so that we can get more work done, because our travel, it's not like we're making money in traveling. Very few people are making it, unless it's trucks and commerce and movement, but for we, the people, getting to work and back, where we make our money is at work. Whether that be in the farms, or whether that be the factories, or business, or what have you. So when we start really evaluating how this relationship between government and so forth, they just took it upon themselves to start creating roads. And they started creating railways and ways of moving, and, you know, mass commerce and so forth. As a matter of fact, they started creating these waterways and water canals. But none of that was done legitimately with the federal government, because I've already given you the example of how Madison, in his veto statement, basically said the federal government does not have the authority to be involved in creating or improving highways, waterways, and those types of things. So as we start looking in the 1800s, there was very limited government. And as we started moving on into the, you know, the late 1800s and early 1800s, there were all sorts of things government started getting involved in. And by this time, they created a Department of Interior, they created a Department of Agriculture, Justice Department, and in the early 1900s, they created the Department of Commerce, Labor, and I forget what the other one was. But actually, they didn't use constitutional amendments to do that. In 1926, it was Calvin Coolidge that championed an amendment to the Constitution, where he basically said, hey, we need to amend the Constitution so the federal government can regulate child labor. And the states actually rejected that. So anyway, long story short, as we start looking at what they can do, what they can't do, and what we see government doing today, in this, at the very bottom of this flow chart, you'll notice that in the county, if we actually look at where the decisions should be made strategically, where they should be started in determining what our infrastructure should be, what our energy policy should be, what, you know, what are these things that would serve us at the county level, at the state level, it has to really, if it's not coming from we the people, then I don't think we're being served, because if you look at our current policies from education, our policies on energy, our policies on housing, and so forth, it doesn't serve us. As a matter of fact, it becomes more and more of a burden to us. I mean, there's reasons why we want to create good standards and those types of things, but they can't be something, because the Ninth Amendment, I'm just going to sidestep here, the Ninth Amendment basically says that no matter what the enumeration is in the Constitution, it cannot be construed to disparage or deny the people of the states their rights. So in other words, if you create a right that, you know, a person should have, or you create a standard that, you know, any family home should have bedrooms for their children, and somebody's been living in for generations in a cabin with no bedrooms, and then the government comes along and says, you can't live there anymore. That's construing a right that they've had, and it basically takes away their right. So that law would violate the Ninth Amendment right. Does that make sense? So that's why the framers were pretty smart in understanding how to create these protections so that we wouldn't actually have government, you know, stepping into every facet of our lives. Another part of the Constitution that people are going to learn about are ex post facto laws. Ex post facto laws are creating a law that basically takes something that was legal, like you bought property and you never put a will on it, but when you bought property, you could get a will. Now they pass a law and say you can't have a will. That's an ex post facto law, and those are unconstitutional. They can't be enforced by the state or the federal government. And so those types of things kind of help us start realizing, wow, they were pretty smart in creating these protections from ex post facto laws, bills of attainder and punishment. Bill of attainder and punishment is a law that basically goes after a class of people, such as, let's say they created a law that says you can't go out in public if you're not vaccinated. That's actually targeting a group of people who made a conscientious decision and punishes them for that. And they can't do that. And so you'll be surprised just how brilliant our federal constitution is, and how what we need to do is basically take that model and implement that into the state and the counties to ensure that we have limited and defined government, and that the government actually, as the, where it needs to grow the most of it all is at the county, and it needs to be constrained at the state. The state needs to be turned into a general government where it serves the sovereignty of the counties and the dignity of the counties and the people who reside there, because there's a reason why people live in the counties that they do. If they're a lumberjack, that means they're close to the mountains or close to lumber. If they're a fisherman, that means they're close to water and the sea, whatever it is. But their interests cannot basically deny you or disparage you your rights and your interests. So as we start going down this path, I there's no doubt in my mind, the people of Stevens County are going to get very smart, and we're going to get we're going to be able to lead the way in actually reclaiming our Republican form of government and actually getting back to a limited and defined government. Because the only way we can actually do this, because it won't come from the court, it won't come from the party, it won't come from a convention of states, it won't come from, you know, all these different, you know, solutions that everybody's proposing. It has to come literally from we the people, and the sanction of it being done under the Republican form of government, or I should say under our legislature, our county legislature, that is what actually gives it its veracity, because it is a derivative of our legislation or our Republican form of government. Does that make sense? Okay, good. Yes. And what is the mechanism of that? Go ahead. Well, so like I said, on the top bar, the top box, there's two ways to do it. You can acknowledge by resolution that we're in a constitutional crisis, or you can receive a First Amendment petition that is actually, you know, saying the fact that the federal government has created this treaty with the UN and all of these other things, because we know that's coming down the pike very quickly, that the World Health Organization is going to try to start creating regulations. So we can get that petition in, and you only need one person's signature, one citizen's signature to petition you. And if you look at that and you examine that and you say, you know what, we think that this has got real weight, and we're going to create a committee, because at the end of every single one of these petitions, And if I think you've looked at my petitions, you know that every single one of them, it calls for the counties to create this committee to initiate the Constitutional Compliance Committee.
It's 2:44 p.m.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, you can. Okay. So, so let me do this, because I'll give you my 2 cents. I don't believe anybody should be in office if they can't pass a fundamental test on the Constitution, because everybody has to take an oath to support it. And if you don't understand it, how can you support it? And as a matter of fact, if you understand the laws in every state, almost every state has laws that say you cannot falsely affirm to an oath. And in other words, if you actually admit that you don't understand the Constitution, that means that you falsely affirmed or swore to an oath. So, you know, when we really start peeling the onion, that right there, you have to have some semblance of understanding the Constitution. But every person that actually is a member, if you go through all the wording, they need to be sworn in just like they're an appointed or an elected person, where they have to take an oath. Just like the sheriffs, just like anybody else is going to be doing a function in government. Okay. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. But let me throw this one here. Because a standard grand jury is 25 people. And I would say that your number should be at least close to 25. So, because that way you actually have a larger voice of the people. So if you go to, if you got three, and then you said, let's do eight per district, then you could kind of divide it that way. Then 8 times 3, you got 24. But, I mean, the standard grand juries are 25. And does Stevens County have a grand jury? But you charge. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, it is. Yes. 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 And as a matter of fact, you could do voting or you can do caucuses, right? I mean, the county already does caucuses. You could actually initiate a caucus to actually have, you know, these meeting places at the schools where people would actually go in, they'd have this caucus to choose who's going to represent out of their district. Boom. Does that make sense? Yes. 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 Yes, and as you guys document all of this, you're creating the template of how other counties could do it, or an assemblance of how they can do it. Does that make sense? Because everybody has, you know, their own way of doing things, and they may want to call it something different, right? Right? Like the counties, the committees of safety, the assembly, general assemblies, all of these different names that the different states came up with. You know, it's as long as they're functioning under the spirit and letter of the same law, I think you're good. That makes sense? Yeah. All right. Yeah, absolutely. So you should have, because you're calling for this committee to be done, and there should be some real essential things that are a part of that. One, the oath and the terms of service, because anybody that tries to inject something that is not founded in the source documents to say, well, I like communism, and we need to redistribute the wealth. So those types of, okay. So you have to have some of those types of things of how to remove people, all of that type of stuff. That's why I went into all these details for you. Okay. No, I need to go myself. I think that there's merit in probably having 30-minute meetings to add, you know, where you come up with questions, we can get together and I can answer those. I'm okay with doing that. I'm here to help. I'm not from the government. You know that. Okay. 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 Awesome. Fine. Oh, I knew that. I knew that. But there's no reason why you can't actually start helping people once you started forming what the nucleus is going to be. Then you really want to actually, because if you notice, there's three sides. The very center is the county, the compliance committee, and the commissioners. The left side is the internal to the county. You want to let people know in the county what's going on, what they're doing, what you're doing. And the right side is promulgating out to the other counties, so that the other counties kind of know what the heck's going on, what you're doing, and that type of stuff. So. Okay. Sure. And, you know, the other thing you may want to consider is start a training class, because if you look at the very side, there are certain things that people need to start learning and understanding. Parliamentarian rules, or is it going to be Robert rules, or what rules are they going to use for functioning as a committee, that type of stuff, because people need to receive that training. People need to receive, you know, some basic training, like I said, on the Federalist Papers, going through why these things are based on contract law and the fundamental tenets. This is why we're doing these things, and I'll be happy to create the class or give the class as an initial process to kickstart this. Okay. Right. You bet. Well, I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the fact that, you know, we've got others wanting to do this, and the opportunity. This is the shot heard around the world. As this starts getting organized, it's just like what those guys did back in the colonies and creating committees of safety. And those, the people that did that ended up becoming Thomas Jeffersons, because that's who rose up to Continental Congress. But we already have a government structure. We have a legitimate government structure. It's just not functioning legitimately with most. It is doing a lot of things that has no legitimacy. So anyway. All right. Thank you. You bet. God bless. Bye.